This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Well, politicians know it and economists know it. Doctors know it and we all know it. Our healthcare system is strained. Some might say it's completely broken. Costs are sky high and good care can sometimes seem pretty tough to get. So what are the forces that are working to turn this around? And is technology one of the keys to changing our experience as patients? Joining me first to talk about this question and more from La Jolla, California, is Dr. Eric Topol. He is the author of The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create Better Healthcare. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine and a cardiologist. Eric Topol, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kara.
So let me first start with something that's pretty provocative that you say in the book. You say, medicine is in some ways broken, and this is a quote, we need a jailbreak. We live in a time of economic crisis because of the relentless and exponentially escalating cost of healthcare, but we've done virtually nothing to embrace or leverage the phenomenal progress of the digital era. So describe the problem as you see it facing us right now and where digitizing medicine can come in.
Right. Well, the first issue is that the way medicine is practiced today is largely at a population level and not focused on the individual. And then the other big problem is that throughout history, the medical community has been the holder, purveyor of all the information, and that's about to change, that information asymmetry, where now consumers can access their own critical data through this technology, and that's going to shift things markedly, and that's very threatening to the medical community.
And you actually say in the book that the American Medical Association has lobbied the government to not let consumers have access to their own genomic data. So why is that?
Right. Well, that's very symbolic, Kara, because that's a threat. That is, I believe that we should have the right to our own data, whether it's our laboratory data as patients or whether it's our DNA data. But the medical establishment, as represented by the AMA, doesn't think that's right and thinks that that should be mediated through doctors or genetic counselors. And, of course, the genetic counselors, while that would be nice, there's only 3,000 of them for 310 million Americans, so that's not going to work. And it turns out that in their own surveys of the AMA, there are only 10% of physicians at most who feel comfortable dealing with genomic data. So that doesn't even make sense. But it's all about the rights of consumers, of the public, and they couldn't get the data before, but now through new tools, like as you introduced smartphones and genomic sequencing, this is going to change and already is starting to change very rapidly. It won't be modulated through doctors in the medical community. It has to come through demands of consumers.
So I guess one of the questions here is, how do you use technology, which we often think of as bringing up costs? I mean, if I wanted to go out and get an iPhone, it wouldn't be cheap, or an iPad or whatever. How do you use that kind of technology or other kinds of technologies to actually bring down costs in healthcare, which clearly healthcare is very expensive right now, and we're having trouble paying for it as a country?
All right. Well, let me give you an example of today. I mean, as a cardiologist, most of my patients have high blood pressure. And as you know, most cell phones are being converted to one smartphone or another. So frequently, because it's so hard to get blood pressure readings, I'll ask patients to get a smartphone and get a device like iHealth or Withings so they can attach to their smartphone and then capture lots of blood pressures, which then get graphed and archived and they can send to me. And this gets the patient engaged. First of all, they didn't have the data before, and now it's fun because they just press start and they have their phone with them all the time anyway. And now we're starting to get a real handle on a very important condition. And, of course, if the blood pressure is controlled, which we know in most of the cases in this country it isn't, but that will help reduce the incidence of heart attacks and strokes. And the app and the hardware is just the same cost as the regular blood pressures you would buy in the store. So here's an example of technology which not only is at the same cost, but actually if it's used more widely and also we improve upon it by it's seamless, where you don't even have to press start, but it's done automatically, we could markedly reduce costs because of the lessened toll of heart attacks and strokes.
Let me bring into the conversation here Jonathan Bush, who's the CEO of Athena Health. And Jonathan Bush, I wonder, here we are talking about smartphones, about tablets like iPads. How much do you see that kind of technology entering either into our lives as patients or into the life of the doctor? I know you work a lot with doctors at Athena Health.
Boy, howdy do I. Kara, thanks, by the way, for having me. Hello, Eric. Yeah, I think the technology, I think Eric mentioned in some of his remarks that, we are blessed with a plethora of tools that have been developed in other market spaces where innovation is allowed, right? And to have innovation, you need many buyers and many sellers and freedom for the buyers and sellers to shop. And that's very hard in healthcare, regulatorily and otherwise. Yeah. But the technology that we need in healthcare or that we could use in healthcare is evolving in other market spaces, and we can borrow it, as Eric described with the kind of a Fitbit or an EKG bit for a cell phone. So I think the possibility for innovation in healthcare is rich. I mean, first of all, the cost is unbelievably high. The price is unbelievably high. So you can make a fortune and still be cheaper than the next guy. Mm-hmm. So that draws entrepreneurial, innovative people in. The tools have been evolving in other market spaces, and we can borrow them. So that's exciting. On the downside, you don't have many buyers, right? The government is half one buyer, and half all the dollars are Medicare and Medicaid. And then there's sort of a smattering of Blue Plans and Aetna, Cigna. So the buying side needs to break up before real innovation takes place. But that could happen.
Dr. Eric Topol, do you see that as a problem, that there's a marketplace, but there's not that many buyers in it, and so it's not very competitive, and so we may not get the best technology and medicine that we need to have?
Well, and I agree certainly with Jonathan's points. I do think that the reason there isn't more of a push forward is that a lot of consumers, the public, just don't know about this. They don't know about these tools and capabilities. And that's the only way it's really going to change, unfortunately. This is not part of any of the healthcare reform or even the ongoing debate. But the idea of each person having their own critical data and having access to that and help and being engaged for the first time. I mean, this is medicine unplugged, and a smartphone is a basis for you can do exams on kids to see whether they have ear infections. You can monitor heart rhythm. I mean, there's a myriad of things one can do with this powerful, portable, mini computer. And that's just the beginning of this shift of information back to patients where it belongs.
And you talk about the idea of Watson, who so many of us remember from Jeopardy. He was the IBM computer that defeated Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter on Jeopardy, people who had won millions of dollars. And you talk about Watson being used potentially to store the world's medical literature and be able to cull through it really quickly and tell you or tell your doctor a lot more about your condition, what tests to provide, that kind of thing. Do you see that really potentially coming into doctors' practices soon?
Well, I think the Watson supercomputer concept is really getting legs. I mean, not only is WellPoint hired Watson, but places like Sloan Kettering in treating complex cancer patients are using it. And here you have the possibility of processing 2 million pages of content in 3 seconds, and it's only going to get better over time. And then just recently, the IBM came out with, we're going to get smartphones so you can connect with supercomputers and like Watson in your pocket. And the whole idea is, why shouldn't every doctor have access to this for, the complexities of what we see with patients who have challenging diagnoses? So that concept of being able to access, big data, the analytics, and the concept of supercomputers is very attractive, and it shouldn't be only, one health insurance company or one particular health system. Hopefully someday this will be pervasive.
Jonathan Bush, what do you think of the idea of bringing in these kinds of analytics, these kinds of tools for doctors to be able to use? So you have something, some real rare disease or even something that's more common, and they realize, well, gee, 70% of people who have this do better when they're treated X way and 50% don't, that kind
right.
of thing.
Well, I guess this is where I might have to disagree a little bit. I think that we are enamored in healthcare of talking about how great huge computers are going to do great huge algorithms and solve great huge problems, but we lose 35% of the abnormal pap smears. Like, we're not anywhere near where we need to be to talk about great huge Watsons solving all massive complex diseases. I think we'll get there, but the way you build a supercomputer is you start with one line of BASIC in 1975, and then that line gets copied and pasted into a whole page of Fortran in 1990 and or in 1980, and then a whole page of MUMPS or a whole ream of MUMPS. And each time, you know, Ray Kurzweil talks about the singularity is near. We're getting to where the
future is, the great future.
Right. And I think that that's where we'll get, and we'll get there quickly. But we need to start with the fact that you can't go from one Harvard-owned hospital 100 yards from here to another one and not have to print out your data and carry it across the street.
When you say the pap smears are lost, you're saying essentially the person had the test and the
came
results
back
are
abnormal.
Just gone.
Woman never found it,
okay.
Never saw it. And everyone goes, oh, I got to go get my annual exam. Well, you don't really, because 35% likely if it's abnormal, you won't find out.
What's worse than that is how about 10 million women a year who have a pap smear who don't even have a uterus or cervix.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of things in medicine that are completely off the track.
This is
I
it.
I agree.
That the innovation starts at the most practical, tactical, ridiculously simple, and then as people master those things, you know, that becomes the base code for the next more sophisticated. So, you know, with Valley Medical here in Central Mass, you know, we started by just saying, look, let's forward the fax machine. Let's just read all the faxes. And sometimes it's a soccer schedule, and sometimes it's a pizza menu, and sometimes it's an abnormal mammogram, right? And so parsing those apart has been, you know, millions of lines of code for Athena and people reading them. But now we're starting to say, hey, you know, guys, how about if it's normal, we file it and communicate directly online with the patient's smartphone and you don't have to look at it. And then we'll take that extra time and, you know, focus on the next patient.
So let's bring in here Dr. Joel Feinman, who's president of Valley Medical Group in Western Mass. And you actually went through this transition from tons and tons of paper records to electronic records. We're talking here about, you know, people having tests, and frankly, the tests have to be redone because the results get lost. What happens when you transition from paper to online records?
Well, one of the things that happens is that you have more immediate access to tests that have been done, and you can tell whether a colleague or another institution already ordered that test, so you don't have to duplicate it. That's one of the cost savings.
Were you duplicating tests before?
We all were. Everyone was. Yeah. Because even when the test was done, as Dr. Tobel said, and the result came back, it often got left in a record room, or it took a few weeks or a few days to file that test in a patient's paper chart. With an electronic record, particularly with the fax being captured and sorted automatically, the result is right there at the doctor's office level when the doctor's with the patient. More importantly, actually, it's available to the doctor's staff so that if you had an appointment with us next week for a follow-up any chronic condition, our staff is checking in the electronic health record to see whether you had the tests we thought we ordered, whether the result was back, and what it was to alert the doctor so that by the time you came in, you and the doctor or practitioner could be discussing the result of that test.
Now, you must have people say to you, look, I don't feel that comfortable with having my medical records online and some, you know, people talk about cloud computing in some cloud somewhere. People can maybe look at them at Athena Health, which is managing your records, but it could be any company. People can look at them online at Valley Medical. I really feel better when it's just in one file folder in one place. What do you say to them?
Well, first of all, we don't get many people saying that anymore. I think folks are so used to working with their ATMs. They're so used to looking stuff up and buying stuff online. In fact, we get more of the opposite. When we weren't electronic, people were asking, why can't I see my results online? But actually, what we would say to them is, yes, you may feel more secure if your result is in a piece of paper in a chart. But the fact is, those charts are not often available at the right place at the right time when you need the information. Whereas electronically, there's one screen. It's all there. Oh, and by the way, if you sign up for our patient portal, which is a secure website that patients can sign up for with a password, they can get those results the same time the doctor does. So if they were in for a pap smear, in for a CBC, in for whatever test it is, they've got those results in front of them. I loved what Dr. Topol said about empowering patients and engaging patients. 40% of our patients are using this portal right now, and I can tell you they would never give it up. And they are involved in their care now. In a way that they weren't before. So it's all about organizing this enormous amount of information, making sure we're not duplicating things, making sure that the transitions, when they occur from hospitals to nursing homes to outpatient, perhaps back again to a consultant, all that information is available. At the primary care level, there's so much information that one needs. People think of primary care as basic care in a way, and specialty care is highly complicated. But actually, there's more information to manage at primary care level than specialty care level. And although I'd love to see a computer be able to do that, and I think I know what Dr. Topol meant when he said that medicine was practiced at the population level, not the individual level, so many primary care doctors and practitioners are still working at the individual level, looking for information. And this is a wonderful way of organizing it.
Dr. Topol, let me come to you on this. We have seen a push from the government towards digitizing these healthcare records, you know, making them easier. And we did see in the past few days, the New York Times do an analysis, and they said that hospitals received $1 billion more in Medicare reimbursements in 2010 than they did 5 years earlier, in part by changing the billing codes that they assigned to patients in emergency rooms. So I wonder if there could be some potential blowback, some potential unintended consequences from digitizing medical records.
Right. Well, that was certainly led to a big flap on yesterday's New York Times about this unintended consequences of electronic records and
right.
capturing more costs. Yes, but you know, this train has left the station. Digitizing one's medical records is a very important step going forward. And like anything else, there's issues of privacy and misuse and hacking and breaches. But this is where we have to go. Digitizing human beings, it's part of it's through their medical records, part of it's through their sensors, their genome, their images. You know, so it's all part of this way that we can get the essence of each person captured to deliver that precision, individualized care. But getting back to the other point, though, is getting patients, the public, engaged. You know, I refer to this as the concept of medical Gutenberg. And, you know, like in the 1400s with the printing press and people learned to read, well, that's what's going to happen now. When people can have their own data, and they should be, they have their electronic record readily accessible through their smartphone or their tablet or whatever. The point is, if they had a test and the results are not accessible, there's something wrong. Going back to the point that Jonathan and Joel were getting at is, you know, that's they have the most vested interest. And now there should be transparency and immediate access, you know, complete access, and they're going to learn to read. And they have the most at stake here. And that's where this is going to eventually go forward, and hopefully we can catalyze this movement.
Certainly there are basic questions that I think a lot of people, let's say you don't know your blood type, and I asked, what's your blood type? Most people would have no idea where to go except calling up their doctor, except I don't think their doctor would tell them on the phone what their blood type is, because that's patient privacy and you can't do that. So it would be hard for them, I think, in a lot of situations to figure out something just that basic as, what is my blood type?
Right. Well, that's not particularly an important one, you know, unless you're having a transfusion. But a lot of other information is indeed critical. But, you know, for example, Kaiser Permanente has a mobile app where you can access anything of your record, of your lab test, of your scans, anywhere you are where there's an internet signal around the world. And that's the way it should be. And that's a very different story than, Kara, the point you brought up about health systems or doctors using medical records to as a lever for increasing charges. This is now, I'm looking and talking about it from the patient public perspective.
And let me finally ask you, and I'm going to ask our other guests about this when we come back, but let me ask you about the politics of this. Certainly, politicians talk a lot about trying to bring down healthcare costs. And I wonder, are politicians putting up barriers to bringing down healthcare costs? Is it just going to happen no matter what they say or do? As you said, the train has left the station. Where do you see us right now? We certainly, obviously, in the middle of an election year.
Right. Well, I'm amazed about this because it's a separate orbit. What's being talked about by the parties and the whole debates about healthcare has nothing to do with, for example, the Institute of Medicine report that just came out about best care, lower cost. And that was showing a $765 billion a year of waste, most of it for unnecessary tests or, you know, lack of precision in medicine. We have the tools to fix that, but nothing's being done. I mean, it's not even part of the discussion right now. And it's a shame because, you know, we didn't have these tools a few years ago, but we sure do have them now.
And do you think, what do you see the trajectory being, even though, as you say, the politicians may not be talking about what's important?
Well, I think the issues are, you know, we have a prescription drug cost of $350 billion a year, and we know at least a third of that is giving the wrong drugs, you know, to the wrong patient or the wrong dose, and we have a lot of genetic information that could fix that. But none of it's being used.
Right.
And you know, the FDA only has so much authority. They can't mandate it. And there's so much reluctance of change in the medical community and lack of comfort, as I alluded to earlier, about this genomic, knowledge base. So these are some things that are just amazing to me that we are not keeping up and using data to be much more precise and avoid this phenomenal amount of waste.
Dr. Eric Topol, author of The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create Better Healthcare, joining us from La Jolla, California. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kara.
And we will be right back, talk more about rebooting our healthcare system and how technology could be the key. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about how our strained healthcare system could benefit from advances in technology to turn things around. And I'm joined by Jonathan Bush, CEO of Athena Health, which is working to digitize medical records and other aspects of healthcare, and Dr. Joel Feinman, president of Valley Medical Group in Western Massachusetts. And Jonathan Bush, let me come to you on the question I was talking to Eric Topol about this issue of politics and what we're talking about sort of on the public stage, at the conventions, that kind of thing, and what's really happening in healthcare. Do you see a disconnect?
It's a massive disconnect. The structural DNA of a state-sponsored, state-run health system is, you know, fairness for all, everyone gets the same thing, and of course, if it's run by a democratically elected group of people, it also represents as many voters as possible. So, whereas all innovation and all creative destruction, to use the phrase that Eric Topol used in his book, comes from the opposite. Remember the Mac ad? Here's to the crazy ones, when no one was buying Macs except for apparently Albert Einstein and Gandhi, you know. But eventually, some crazy ones went there and they acted a lot cooler than we lamos that were on the, you know, Microsoft platform. And in the end, you know, Microsoft, wasn't it in one of your shows where they were talking about Microsoft spends like five times more than Apple?
Yes, yes.
And they suck like five times more also, right?
Something like that.
That's not the clinical term, but you know, politicians create barriers to destruction because that's their job, and established institutions try to protect homeostasis of their institutions. And what we need, as you point, as Eric pointed out in the IOM study, and as you point out in the New York Times, is kind of the destruction. I mean, another study is the Dartmouth Atlas study, which shows that we have and use 43% more hospital beds than we need. And about half of them are sitting here in downtown Boston. We are massively overbedded. But it isn't going to be the institutions downtown that blow up their own beds. It's going to be institutions like Valley that say, you know what, we can do that in the clinic. We don't need to do that in the hospital. And that thing we were doing in the clinic, we can get you to do that at home on your Fitbit, and we can just monitor monitor you remotely. Or maybe patients will say, I don't really need to do this at all because I can self-care on this lower-end stuff. It's got to be from the outside in. And when the money's on the inside going out, it makes it a little harder and slower.
Yeah. So then where does the impetus come from? If there's, you know, people in hospital beds who really don't need to be there, that's perfectly fine for an outpatient situation. Where does change
right.
come
so
from?
So who can shop? In every other sector in our society, the consumer shops, says, screw you, I'm going to keep the money. Or, you know what? I love this. I'm going to get a platinum hip. I'm not going to get a cartilage hip because I want it. And there'll be amazing platinum hips, and there'll be amazing fake, you know, cheap hips, and there'll be innovation. There'll be crazy ones who move back and forth. It won't be a peer-reviewed committee that says, these are the only hips because they're the fairest and they're the most, whatever, efficient for 300 million people averaged in. Right? That idea of crazy people trying crazy things, that shopping is what's missing. I personally believe that the first generation of shoppers, the generation before us today, are doctors. That doctors that aren't employed by hospitals for the purpose of keeping the hospital full, but independent clinics who could go to health insurance companies or employers and say, I got ways of making these patients happier and healthier if you give me the money and the ability to shop. Let me click on mammogram and see all the different places I could get you one, and maybe even negotiate, say, hey, you know, Happy Valley Medical Center over here, if you dropped your price 20%, I'd send all my patients to you. Today, the health plan can't do it because they can't lose Happy Valley from their network. The government can't do it because that would be incredibly unfair and nobody at Happy Valley would vote for them, right? But a doctor representing a pile of patients, the patient can't do it, right, because it's not their money. But if the doctor could get in there and get risk, get money, and then say, listen, if I shop better, make people happier, and there's money left over, give me that. That fuels innovation. That, much more than any top-down law, incentive, yada, yada, that we hear about all the time, will incent movement. And I actually think Valley does a lot.
Yeah, so Joel Fineman, let me bring you in on this. I could see you want to get in. What's your experience here in terms of that effort to bring down costs and incentive?
Well, in a way, we're already there. We've at least taken the first couple of steps. Jonathan's right about the places for innovation, where they occur. But we also have, because we're in a market-driven society, a lot of experiments going on all the time and a lot of duplication of effort. And that's held us back a bit. But right now at the practice level, within the practice, we have a way of reducing costs by knowing what information's already there and how we've used it, and by reaching out to patients and getting them involved. But we're already seeing, because of some of the programs, that the politicians have created, some efforts of doctor groups around the country and in our area in particular, working together now to look jointly at what's the best way to approach a particular problem. How do we make sure that when I'm a cardiologist, my consult gets to you, the primary care doctor, in lightning time, so that when your patient is back there, you've got that result. Oh, and also, how do we make sure that I don't repeat a test you did in your office? And some of this is being done because they're creating financial incentives for doctor groups and hospitals to talk together and to make sure that care is delivered at the right level, that we don't send somebody to the emergency room when they could get stitched just as well in a doctor's office, that we don't send them there for common colds and things like that.
Jonathan,
so we're already moving there, I guess is what I'm saying.
They're way ahead, though. You got to understand, Valley, I mean, just fun fact for your next cocktail party on healthcare. We spend $463 per living soul, $463 per living soul per month in the commercial population, not the older people dying, all that. And these guys are at like three and change, yeah. 360, something like that. So they're already miles ahead. They're all these, you know, hippie Central Mass, Kaiser guys trying stuff, coordinating. So they are, it is starting, but it's nowhere near compared to what we could do.
Okay, so let me ask you about other countries. Now, we often see...
In other countries, people shop.
Okay, so in other countries, in many industrialized countries, Japan, Australia, England, there is France, there is general ownership of the healthcare system by the government. So how do they have set so much of a lower cost per person? Are they ahead technologically? What is enabling them have lower costs?
So if you do the math, just line it up. The single biggest driver of cost, it's even more than price. So we have really high priced doctors, make a lot of money, et cetera.
Right.
Which they should, Joel, just so you know, it's very important that
Thank
they make
you.
A lot of money. But is asset utilization. So we'll skip France. We'll go from Boston to India, right? And we'll have a board certified valve repair, you know, open heart surgery by a Harvard-educated doctor right here at a Harvard institution. And then we'll have another one right over here in Bangalore, okay? The one in Bangalore is going to cost 85% less with identical outcomes. The guy got educated at the same place. He actually does more procedures per month than the guy here. If you look at your first instinct, oh, well, everybody in India makes a lot less money.
Right.
So that must be that. And 20% of the savings is that. It's just that the nurses, everybody makes way less. But the equipment is actually more. So you actually have to spend about 15% more on equipment, the same equipment in India than you do here. Importation, I don't know why, but just is that. The biggest difference is asset utilization. There are no granite pavilions that you walk into with, you know, glass elevators going around to get your surgery. There's a building whose purpose is doing that surgery. And by the way, if you're willing to get it late night, you can get a better rate because they want to use that asset all day. Well, think about it.
Your off-peak bypass.
Off-peak bypass. Listen, the point is that equipment and the process took forever and a fortune to assemble. The doctor gets better and better all the time. In this country, it's illegal for that doctor to offer a discount and make a play like that. But the asset utilization is massively improved.
Yeah, but most hospitals in the U.S. are not granite pavilions with glass elevators. I mean, maybe some
have
are.
Have you ever been to the lobby of a hospital that wasn't granite? I go to hospitals for a living. If you want to find a crane in America, follow the blue H. It's unbelievable. And the asset utilization of the equipment is through the floor. Low. Forget the lobby. That's just, most people recognize the lobby of the hospital with the volunteer in the light blue smock, you know, with blue hair. But the thing I'm worried about is there's a race to get all the equipment. Nobody can flush another guy out of business and get his or her volume in a market where prices are fixed by the government. And so there's no play there. And it's very hard to enter as a new buyer. I think that one movement that will create innovation in the next few years, because employers got kept in Obamacare and the PAPACA legislation, I expect, and here's more of your politics question, I expect employers, as technology becomes more sophisticated, will activate themselves. They'll say, this HMO doesn't do anything to negotiate price for me. They stopped doing that when they all merged up in the late 90s. We did have about 8 years where healthcare got cheaper every year, where GDP went up more than health, you know. And it was because HMOs were beating the crap out of doctors and hospitals and paying doctors extra to do surgeries outside of the hospital. There was a whole battle going on. Then the HMOs got in a lot of trouble. You know, Barbara Walters asking the guy, why did you not let this man get a new kidney? You know, and some guy at Humana is going, what's going on here? But that dynamic of shopping power, of bargaining power, is gone from the health insurance space. I think employers will equip groups, medical groups, or even hospitals in town here, they're steward healthcare. So all of a sudden, these guys have formed capital and said, I want to make your healthcare cheaper. Let me shop for you. Let me be your shopper. I think shopping makes
innovation. So then, is it possible that the center of gravity is shifting from politicians in Washington or at the state level to employers who realize how much money, how much of their budget is going to these healthcare reimbursements for their employees, and they're going to start chopping around?
Absolutely. So Washington is the ultimate E.F. Hutton, right? I mean, when they blink, think about talking in any way, everyone listens. They stop what they're doing. Like, for example, consumer-directed health plans. These are plans where the consumer controls and pays, and if there's a savings, they keep it, right? They were on the rise right up until the election, until the inauguration. When Obama was inaugurated, there was talk of a nationalized healthcare. All the employers said, whoa, I'm not going to keep sticking it to my employees if Ed McMahon's going to come with a big cardboard check and give it away. I'd rather keep my employees. I don't want to be a less attractive place. Now that the government stopped moving, if in fact it has stopped moving, then employers will go back to try to figure out what they can do to reduce the cost of having an employee.
Well, one of the things employers are doing is they are still continuing to push more of the cost onto the employee.
And yeah, it's back.
One of the things that we're seeing is we now have a situation where some patients are reluctant to come in because they know they're going to have to pay a bigger chunk of a copay or a coinsurance. And we're constantly battling against that at this point. And the only way to get around that, aside from reform of the way benefits is structured, is to have a really good relationship between the patient and the physician or other practitioner working with them. And the only way to do that is to have the right information at the right time.
Let me finally ask you, Joel Fineman, how does this change, how do you see this changing the life of a doctor in 5, 10, 15 years? How is their life going to be different every day when they go into the office than it is now?
Well, I hope it's going to be more organized and have more time to actually engage patients and work directly with them. The right information at the right spot is great. But patients coming back to doctors and back to healthcare practitioners saying, I just noticed this lab, or I can see from my health information that I'm supposed to get this immunization, and engaging in some dialogue about this is really the place where we need to get to. Physicians and other practitioners are working very hard right now every day to see as many patients as possible because we're all getting older. We're all acquiring more chronic illnesses. There are more procedures and more medicines that can be prescribed now than ever. And all that information is almost impossible to manage unless you have some kind of help from technology, but more importantly, help from the consumer, help from the person who's got whatever the issue is, doing their own investigation, seeing their own results, coming back and talking with us, being open to work with the healthcare practitioner. It's their life. It's their records, their information.
And Jonathan Brooks, a final question for you. When you look out at other countries, what you're saying then is that even though there's a lot of nationalized healthcare systems, even in those healthcare systems, you see more competition than you do in this one.
Oh, no, in a national, so we skipped France. So in France, they just say, look, there's only going to be one PET scanner in Boston, and you're just going to line up and use it because we're going to keep it busy. Here, it's sort of half socialized and half not socialized. So,
Combination is extremely expensive.
That's right. What I see happening is if groups like Joel's prosper, and you know certainly Joel's is prospering, but if they keep going, and if other players start to get a hold of this information and use it to actually build packaging, build pricing and packaging around healthcare, so that there's alternatives to Blue Cross or Medicare, then you're going to see shopping. Then you're going to see people trying stuff. You already heard Joel say, doctor or the practitioner, right? So many patients would rather see a nurse practitioner who's got more time and is more available and frankly isn't so fixated on disease. Many doctors would rather see a lot fewer well patients and really only see vexing sick ones.
Right.
That would do the same thing, asset utilization improvement, right? Improve the utilization of that doctor's skill set. All of that is ripe right now to happen, and that's going to be the shopping that leads to that kind of redeploying of assets. That's going to be where innovation really kicks off.
And we will watch that game change. We have been talking about healthcare and how technology could make things better and easier from doctors to patients. And I've been speaking with Jonathan Bush, CEO of Athena Health, and Joel Fineman, president of Valley Medical Group in Western Massachusetts. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3.
Kara, I know you're a political junkie. Have you had your fix for the week?
Never, really.
Well, there's more for you. Our New Hampshire insiders are going to check. We're going to check in with them and find out from analysts Arnie Arneson and Fergus Cullen their take on how the local and national races are playing out in the Granite State. And what happens in New Hampshire, we know, influences the rest
it
of the
sure
presidential
does, yeah.
campaign. I'm Callie Crossley.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.
On the hill of my own.